on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
That was General Dwight D. Eisenhower on June 6th, 1944. Our guest today, 92-year-old Mel Cobb of Fresno, California, heard that message in England. The words you just heard are printed along with General Eisenhower's signature in Mr. Cobb's exquisitely preserved copy of the history of his outfit, the 850th Engineer Aviation Battalion. 10 days after that order of the day launched the invasion of Normandy, Mr. Cobb and his fellow engineers were headed across the English Channel. What did you encounter when you got to Utah Beach about 2 weeks after D-Day?
It was clear for us because the infantry was ahead of us. Mm-hmm. That was the only way that saved us. We were out in the channel at midnight because we were waiting for the tide to rise, because if the tide rises, those LSTs that they would take off of the ship to go to shore, they wanted the tide up be high enough so that they could go to shore quite a ways instead of waiting for the low tide, because it'd be too far out. We hit that about 6:30, I think, something like that, in the morning, when the tide was high, because it was 25 men, you know, with all the guns and stuff that we had on. We had to carry that with us, and that's the reason they wanted to get us closer to the shore on high water rather than low water.
So what were you carrying as you went ashore?
Well, I had my helmet, and my gas mask, my gun. I had 100-and-some rounds of ammunition, and had my mess kit and my clothes, whatever I had.
What did you find? Can you describe for us what that scene was like on Utah Beach when you went ashore?
What could I call I could see was dead GIs and dead Germans. Well, you'd have to see it to believe it. You know, you can have, they can show you pictures and you can and see what's happening there. But when they hit the shore, the guy on the ship put you on those LCTs, and then when you went to shore and you hit the bottom, then they said, all off, and you go. You don't wait. That was the message that we had to get off of that as fast as we could. But just like I say, but we were pretty, I would say, pretty safe maybe, because we didn't go right with the infantry. We was right behind the infantry.
So you were safe, but you were confronted with this evidence that not everybody was. What was it like for you to see the bodies everywhere, to experience that scene?
It was so many bombs dropped, and what happens is the bombs were so heavy that it would break the concussion, bladder concussions on the cows and horses and stuff like that. So that's what you would see too, along with 100 dead GIs and hundreds of Germans and the whole bit.
And did that rattle you? Did that make you emotional?
Well, no, you just have to fight and go. So fight and go. It wasn't no holding back. When they tell you come off that LCT, you came off of it. You wasn't no backing off. It was one way off, one way out, and that was lower the lid and take off. You could find a place where we could stop and, you know, sit down and figure out where we're going to go and where we're going to be and what's going to happen.
And you were, if I do my math right, you were 23 years old at the time. Were you afraid? Were you concerned that you might not come back?
No. We had a job to do. Things are different now. I mean, you know, but there was no way out.
Did you feel that someone was looking out for you? Someone would protect you? Or?
Good man upstairs.
Well, and I ask that because you talked about your father and how serious he was about keeping Sunday as a day of rest for your family and all that. And so that just made me wonder if you had a belief that God would protect you when you were overseas.
Yes. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here.
Well, and I want to hear about some of those things that you experienced, that you were fortunate to survive. You came ashore there, and you moved through France building runways, but this isn't, you know, naked virgin ground you're building runways on. You guys had a lot of work to do before you could build a runway. What all went into that?
We tried everything. We even put gasoline and oil, laid some kind of felt down for the planes, but that didn't work because the planes would hit it and tear it off. They had built what they call a pierced steel blank. It came in 6 foot by 2 feet wide. And you laid that down, and then you had to kind of interlock itself. And then you had to have a little thing that you drove in so when they hit it, it didn't snap out. It was just like a piece of metal. You drove it in there, and that kept it from coming out. That's what we used mostly. In fact, we built one way in Germany out of red brick, 2 layers.
But before you could even do that part of the job, a lot of times you had to make sure there were no explosives left behind. How often did you go out detecting mines?
Well, that was the first thing you did. You went out with your mine detectors, and then if you found everything all right, then we took we had bulldozers and stuff like that. Then you had to level the ground, and so it all took a lot of work in order to get the ground right for the pilots to land.
Well, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm just imagining going out in an area where you've never been before with a mine detector, knowing there's a reason you have to use it, that there could be a mine anywhere you step. It seems a little nerve-wracking to me. How did you deal with that pressure?
Well, you just have to be sure, feel sure you got this mine detector is going to protect you. But you have to know, and they had a way, some of the higher officers had a way of when they laid a mine detector in a group, there was only one way they could do it. Somehow we found out that the way it was, so if you found a mine, then you could probably, just like I say, take your mine detector and go and find the way they had set them out there for you.
You figured out the pattern that they used. And what if you did detect a mine, what would you do next?
Well, we'd have to go there. They have a what they call like a pin light. You'd have to put that in there, so if you picked it up, to make sure it wouldn't go off. And the same thing with a lot of the other stuff they had. You had to have a pin there for it to go. Once you pull that pin, and it's just like throwing a hand grenade. Once you pull that pin, you got to let it go. So you had to figure out how to did it. But we had mines there, so we knew what we were doing, knew how to, you know, not set them off.
You knew how to neutralize that trigger mechanism. Do you have any memories of that stand out, of a time that particularly made you a little anxious?
No, not necessarily, because it was a dangerous thing to do. You've never done nothing like that before, but you got your training. You took training to know how to do that kind of stuff before they even sent you in there. If you got there and if you knew what you had to do and knew how to do it, then it was okay.
What was your rapport like with your fellow aviation engineers, the other guys you spent all this time around?
Oh, we had some wonderful guys. You know, our company was A company, and it, just like I say, it had a B company, C company, and headquarters. And all the guys, we knew each other. We worked together. We fought together. Everything that we did it together.
How did the pilots treat you guys?
Pilots, you know, they did the job. A lot of them would come back with part of the wings off, or tail lights part of it blown off. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing how these pilots could take a plane like that and land it we'd build a runway, and then we'd build a strip for ones that were coming back that would crack, you know, crash when they come back. Then we had a side place for them to land on instead of the runway. If they got one on fire, well, they just pulled it out to the emergency, and some of them jumped out and some of them didn't.
I imagine you spent a lot of time around airplanes?
Yes, yes, quite a bit of time.
Did you have a favorite plane that would come through that if it was coming in for a landing, you just had to watch?
P-51s. P-51s and P-47s, those were all our fighter planes. When the big bombers went on a mission, they would always send some P-51s or P-47s in amongst with the hundreds and hundreds of all them big bombers going over, because the Germans could get in there with their fighter planes. So that was mainly one of the P-51s and 47s that went in. Whenever they went on a mission, they would take them with them.
That was the reason you had to build those runways, so those fighter planes would have some place to take off and land. But those runways, those air bases throughout Europe, were also targets of the enemy. Were you ever at an airstrip when the Germans came and bombed you or shot at you?
We had literally some kind of huts that we were lived on in. And we always had some place to go because we had meetings every night. And it was just like wooded area, like. And it had big ditches. And a lot of times they'd be coming before we could even get out of there. We'd jump over into those ditches there because they would be dropping bombs, you know.
What goes through your mind when you're huddled down in a ditch hoping the bomb doesn't have your name on it?
It probably had my hand on it. But I'll tell you a little story. We were in France, and we were getting bombed so much because we was still building these runways. I dug a hole in my underneath of my bunk, and then whenever they had would strafe us, then planes would come over strafing us. I'd put some boards over there and get down in that bunk and stay there till the raid was over with.
Did you ever have any close calls that way?
Yeah, closest one was in a tent. They strafed the tent, and it just like you could take a shotgun and shoot through it. It had bullet holes all full through it. But I was down on the ground, so I was safe, I guess. I don't know.
So you're in a tent, and you're on the ground, or you're under the ground because you dug a hole?
I'm under the ground. Uh-huh. I got my, like this is my bunk. I'll dig a hole and get down in there and then put some boards on top of it and get down in there while they're strafing.
So they're strafing, you hear the rat-a-tat-tat and all the noise going everywhere, and then it's quiet, you finally come back up and you find your tent full of holes?
Yep, that's right.
What does that do to you?
Another day.
Yeah, you would live to see another day, and I know there are a lot of people who are very thankful for that. We need to take another break, but when we come back, we'll hear more of Mr. Cobb's experiences in World War II, and I'll tell you how you can make a difference in the week ahead, when and where you need to be there to welcome home 70 World War II veterans from an unforgettable journey to the World War II Memorial. Hometown Heroes will be back in a moment, but as we head to break, how about a little music from the time we're talking about? Mr. Cobb discussed meeting his wife dancing in Fresno. A few of you have asked me lately why I haven't played any of those old World War II era songs recently. So ask and you shall receive. More of Mr. Cobb's story when we come back.
Once there was a little girl who lived next to me, and she loved a sailor boy, he was only three. Now he's on a battleship in his sailor suit, just a great big sailor, but she thinks he's very cute.
With his bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor, and he loves her too.
Her sailor boys away on the ocean blue. Soldier boys all flirt with her, but to him she's true. though they smile and tip their caps and they wink their eyes. She just smiles and shakes her head, then she softly sighs.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue. She loves her sailor and he loves her too.
When her sailor went to see what he could see, she saw that he ate spinach, now he's big as he can be. When he's home they stroll along, they don't give a hoot. She won't let go of his hand even to salute. If her sailor she can't find on the bounding main, she is hopeful he will soon come home safe again. So they can get married and raise a family, dress up all their kiddies in sailor's dungarees.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor and he loves her too.
The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selzler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.